Will you turn with me, please, to the 19th chapter of 1 Kings? 1 Kings, chapter 19. If you were with us last Sunday morning, you might recognize, even from our reading, that it would be hard to find a sharper contrast than the picture of Elijah we had last Sunday in 1 Kings 18, challenging all the forces of hell on Mount Carmel, with the Elijah we meet in chapter 19, and the picture we have of him trembling, forlorn, plunged into what looks like a period of real spiritual darkness and depression, and even reaching the point where he cries to the Lord in verse 4, "It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life. I am at the end of the road," is what Elijah is saying. And whereas in chapter 18, he is the towering spiritual giant who is crying to God to reveal his nature and vindicate his glory by answering by fire, here he cries to God to take him out of a world in which he feels he can live no longer. This was probably the darkest hour in Elijah's life, as chapter 18 was probably his greatest hour. And it really is very good and gracious of God, if you think of it, to give us this very honest picture of this towering giant of a man, to show us that he was a man of like passions as we are. Because doubtless some of us have felt like this, I imagine that many of us have known what it is to say with Elijah, "Lord, I have had enough. I am just about at the end of my tether." And to know a feeling of profound hopelessness and despair and depression creeping over our spirit. And the really ghastly thing about such a dark hour in spiritual experience is that you can often be persuaded either by yourself or by well-intentioned friends, or more than likely by the devil, that no true Christian should ever go through such an experience as this. Well, here is one of God's giants in the middle of it. And these things were written for our instruction and learning and encouragement, that through the comfort of the Scriptures, we might learn to have hope even in such hours as these. Now, for the sake of clarity, I want to try to gather together the main elements in this situation by focusing upon three things this morning. And I'll tell you what they are so that you will know where we are going as we look together at the chapter. I want to look first of all at the characteristics of this experience of Elijah's. Secondly, at the causes of it. And thirdly, at the cure for it in the measure in which God gave him a cure at this time. First of all, the characteristics or the elements in this experience of Elijah, for there are certain clear marks in it, and we need to try to tease them out a little bit. What was it that brought him primarily to this point where he cries out to God, this man who had known such exaltation and spiritual triumph, who seemed to have been a man of such amazing strength of character, who stood before Ahab and was able to be God's mighty and courageous messenger? What was it that brought him to this point of trembling weakness, this sense of utter hopelessness, this desire to get out of the world? Death was preferable to almost anything else that he could think of. Well, primarily, I think it was a feeling of total exhaustion. I think that is what is contained in the phrase in verse 4, "It is enough, O Lord." And this kind of exhaustion which Elijah was experiencing is not just the same thing as feeling tired. It is the sort of exhaustion, a deep weariness which touches every area of your life, physical, mental, spiritual, and emotional. It's often expressed by people in the terms, not I am excessively tired, but I just cannot go on. And this overwhelming sense of a pervading exhaustion that makes it sometimes almost impossible to think, and sometimes also impossible to act, is the primary element in Elijah's experience. He had known this sort of exhaustion. He had been journeying in all sorts of different ways, under stress of all sorts of different forms, and he was feeling totally exhausted. It was also a feeling of total personal worthlessness, do you notice? In verse 4, he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness, came and sat down under a broom tree, and he asked that he might die, saying, "It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life." Why? "Because I am no better than my fathers." Now that is not just a normal, healthy sense of our own unworthiness before God, because that is something which many of us know a great deal in our lives, a sense of deep unworthiness. And we recognize the fact that all that God has given to us, we are in no sense and never can be worthy of it. This is not what Elijah is experiencing. This is an exaggerated sense of an utter uselessness to God or to anybody else. It probably is accompanied by an overwhelming sense that the only thing God ought to do to him is to judge him. And he will be experiencing a morbid, nagging kind of self-accusation, which keeps on nagging away at his spirit all the time. And that sense of a total personal worthlessness is part of Elijah's feeling. I am no better than my fathers. He has a feeling of great failure, inner failure, personal failure, spiritual failure, failure in his ministry, failure in every sphere. You ever felt like that? Elijah, a man subject to like passions as we are. It was accompanied, thirdly, by a feeling of total loneliness. In verse 3 we read that he left his servant at Beersheba, do you notice? Then he was afraid and he arose and went for his life and came to Beersheba because Jezebel, that wickedest of women in the Bible, Jezebel was hounding him. And he went to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and he left his servant there, but he himself alone went a day's journey into the wilderness. And in verse 10, this is one of the things that he complains about to God. When God says to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah? I've been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altar, slain thy prophets with the sword, and I only am left. There is no one else, Lord," he says, "I have this excessive experience of loneliness. There is nobody else who stands with me." Now that is an element in this kind of experience that people go through which is profound and real. It is a loneliness which is an inner loneliness that makes you often feel that there is absolutely nobody else in the world, but certainly in the Christian church, who has ever experienced this sort of thing that you are going through. And it is one of the things the devil plays upon, of course, to make you feel this. Again and again, you will have found this with other people, if not in your own experience. It's part of this kind of depression, that nobody else has ever known this. But the strange thing about this experience that Elijah is going through is that you not only feel lonely, you also deprive yourself of company. Do you notice that in verse 3? He was afraid and arose and went for his life, came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and he left his servant there. Now the servant was probably somebody who was very close to him. But he said to him, "You stay here, I can't stand anybody else at the moment. I'll need to go into the wilderness alone." And it's a very interesting and significant thing that people who have this great loneliness that is part of this experience at the same time deprive themselves of company. Total exhaustion, total worthlessness, total loneliness. Let me just point out to you one or two other elements in his distress. One is a deep-seated sense of fear. You get that again in verse 3. He was afraid and arose and went for his life. Now, that was not characteristic of Elijah. He seems to have been a man of great bravery and courage. But at this particular point, in the midst of this exhaustion, he was trembling and terrified. And in verse 10, again, he cries to God, I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. The people of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, and so on. And I only am left, and they seek my life to take it away. And this paralyzing fear can often be an index of this experience Elijah was going through. You will notice also that perhaps the other main element in it was an irrational attitude to all sorts of things. What I mean is that people in this situation, like Elijah, don't really think straight and can't. Have you noticed this? It's a very real factor. Look at Elijah's plea to God, for example, in verse 4. He asked that he might die. He said to God, it is enough, take away my life. Now, it's a very interesting thing, this, if you think of it, because I can easily imagine God saying to him, now, Elijah, do you really want to die? And Elijah would have said, of course, it's the only thing that I want now, to die. And God would have said to him, why are you running away from Jezebel? Because she's just waiting to oblige. That's the very thing Jezebel wants to do for you. She wants to kill you. But you see, there is this irrational tendency. People don't think clearly. They have got these movements of emotion which are never really rational. And Jezebel, who was hounding him to death, had brought this fear into Elijah's spirit. And Elijah cries out to die, and yet he doesn't really want to die. He's running away from death. And this is why at such a time you find that clear, rational thought, the normal characteristic of Elijah's experience, was gone. Now let me just point out in a word to you some of the causes which seem to lie behind this distress. Of course we need to recognize that there are natural causes, and when someone is in the midst of this kind of spiritual experience, because it is part of the spiritual experience of Elijah, there are natural causes. You might be inclined to call them physical causes, but I'm thinking of things more wide than that. His body probably was exhausted through a great deal of energy that he had expended. You will notice that at the end of chapter 18, Ahab rode and went to Jezreel, and the hand of the Lord was on Elijah, and he girded up his loins and ran before Ahab to the entrance of Jezreel. Now that distance from Carmel to Jezreel is something like 18 miles, which is quite a sprint for a middle-aged man like Elijah. And he traveled in a frightened condition to Beersheba after he had gone to Jezreel and expended an enormous amount of emotional energy in the confrontation with the prophets of Baal. And above all, perhaps he had expended an enormous amount of spiritual energy. And as he came to this place in the wilderness under the juniper tree, or the broom tree as the RSV calls it, he was certainly in the midst of a natural kind of exhaustion. It may well be that under the heading of natural causes, one should take seriously the suggestion that has sometimes been made that Elijah may have been the sort of personality who was capable of great heights and correspondingly capable of great depths. And that's a significant thing in this kind of experience. The mountain and the wilderness represent two areas of Elijah's life. The man who is capable of great exaltation is also capable of great depths of depression. But let me bring you a little more closely to the spiritual causes of this experience. It may well be that in his exhausted condition, Elijah has been opening himself to the danger of taking his eyes off God and focusing them on himself and his circumstances and Jezebel and all that she stood for. And as he does so, of course, this is one of the causes of this experience that he is going through. Here is Elijah, the man who stood out as the man whose whole life was taken up with God. We were seeing that last Sunday, with his glory and with his honor. But now here is Elijah in the darkness of self-despair and self-pity. And there is no question that Elijah was experiencing true spiritual depression as part of his exhaustion, and part of the result of the exhaustion probably was that his eyes were taken away from God to himself. Now that's often a mark of this experience. It may also be that it is important to notice that one of the reasons God brought Elijah at Horeb to listen to this still small voice was that he had been listening too much to the words of Jezebel and too little to the words of God. However that may be, I have no doubt that the deepest element in his problem was the satanic attack, which is part of this. I'm sure this is the influence behind Jezebel, this evil woman with the weak kingly husband who was like putty in her hand. Ahab is a man who commands almost no respect, as we read through the history of him in 1 Kings. He is Jezebel's poodle rather than her husband, and a man of great weakness. But again and again, you discover that through somebody like Jezebel, the evil one is able to come and create havoc in the life of such a man as Elijah. And this irrational fear in Elijah's heart is certainly something that one could readily trace back to the powers of darkness. It was this that made him stampede into the wilderness, a somewhat temporary blinding of the man to the character and purpose of God. Clearly there is one area where the devil seeks to deal with Christian people in this kind of situation, and that is to get them away from the ground of grace. Now, I think that's one of the most important things that people need to learn passing through this kind of experience, however mild it may be. And there are milder and more serious forms of this experience, but we all of us in some form or another go through it. And one of the primary things the devil seeks to do is to draw God's servants and God's children away from the ground of grace and onto some other ground of ourselves, our own achievement, our own failure, or whatever. Now that's what Elijah is betraying when he says, "I am no better than my fathers." God might well have answered, "Who said you were?" It's got nothing to do with whether you're better than your fathers or not. The primary thing is that I am the living God, and I am able to be to you everything that you need through every crisis hour of your life. But here he is being plunged into great despair about himself, you see, focusing upon himself. And what he needs desperately is to have his eyes lifted up to God, his ears open to his word. And this is where, my dear friends, there is an enormous importance attached to Christian doctrine. Because, you see, if your hope is in the grace of God and in grace alone, If you recognize that you are saved by grace and only by grace, and that there is nothing else that you can ever rest upon but the grace of God, not grace and something, but grace and nothing, then you will in some measure be protected and undergirded in the midst of this kind of experience. I find it's this that I increasingly have to talk to people about in whatever measure they may find themselves. Cast down, as the apostle says. It is the doctrine of grace, that we are saved by grace, that we are kept by grace, that we are restored by grace, that we will be glorified by grace and grace alone. Now you really need to be resting in that. Let me bring you now to the way in which God dealt with Elijah, the cure, if you like, for his experience. The first element in the cure, of course, was that God did not answer Elijah's prayer. He had a far higher purpose for Elijah than he had ever thought of. You are not going to die, was what Elijah was being told by God. Not now and not ever, in fact, because Elijah was not going to taste death. He was going to be translated. And often when you are depressed, you really can't pray right anyway. That is part of the experience. And what God was doing was saying to Elijah, now just be quiet, my child. He says, what you really need is not to pray, but to sleep. You thought of that? You say, how unspiritual. Well, that's what God did. He said to him, don't bother all these confused prayers, Elijah. He says, just go to sleep. And then he sent an angel to bake the original angel cake, and brought him cake and water, and he said to him, wake up, Elijah. He said, wake up and have something to eat. Isn't it amazing how practical and real God is in a situation like this? He recognized that the man's spiritual, emotional, mental depression needed to be brought to the physical things that the man was needing cared for. It needed to be attacked from that end, as it were. And when he cried to God, God, he said, take away my life. He said, now, no prayers, Elijah, just now. No prayers. Sleep, first of all. And then something to eat. And the cake baked by the hands of angels. And then he said, go back to sleep again. And then he woke him up again. And he said, have some more. And Elijah had some more. And he went back to sleep again. And this was God's treatment for him. Because the man was exhausted. He needed rest for his body. He needed rest for his mind. He needed rest for his soul. And this is how God first was giving it to him. But it was not just that he needed cake and water and sleep. One of the primary things that God is assuring him of at this stage is of his love. Now that's one of the things that when you're in this kind of situation, you most desperately need, because you feel nobody loves you, nobody cares for you, nobody understands you, and God comes along, and through this practical ministry, he is bringing to Elijah the assurance that he is a God of love and a God of tender mercy and a God who cares and who draws his child into the embrace of his care. Oh, the tender thoughtfulness of God. You notice when he comes with his hand upon Elijah, the hand of the Lord was upon Elijah. It's one of the great phrases about Elijah. But when the hand of God was extended to Elijah in this situation, it was not with a wagging finger. It was with an open-handed provision. And he came to him, and then with a gentle touch in his head, waken up, Elijah. Go back to sleep, Elijah. Eat and be fed and be satisfied. We really do need to notice the loving, gentle way in which God comes. And this is the assurance that Elijah and those who have known something of this experience greatly need. Now you'll notice that in the next place he gets Elijah to talk it out. In verses 9 and 10, there he came to a cave and lodged there, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah?
Now, many people have wondered what God was meaning when he said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Was he meaning, "What are you doing here, Elijah? What are you doing here, Elijah? What are you doing here, Elijah?" Or, "What are you doing here, Elijah, of all people?" People wonder what it is that God meant. But I think possibly the simplest thing is that God was simply wanting the man to tell him what it was all about. He says, "Let's sit down, Elijah, and you talk." And Elijah said in verse 10, "I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken thy covenant." He has been in the midst of disappointing spiritual experience. He has been disappointed in what has happened. Israel has not turned to the Lord as he had hoped they might. The altars of God have been thrown down. The prophets have been slain. And he feels this desperate loneliness of obedience to God, you see. And often it's important to do that more than once. It was for Elijah. You notice in verse 14 again, he almost says exactly the same things to God. Now, that's not just a repetition. It's rather important because I think this is what people often do in these circumstances. They almost always use the same phrases, coming back over the same thing again and again and again. And God allows Elijah to talk the thing out. Next, you notice he restored Elijah to his word. I think this is basically what God is doing at Horeb from verse 11 onwards. It may be that Elijah had been too much taken up with the dramatic and with the impressive things like fire on Carmel, but God wants to impress upon him the vital place where he acts and dwells, which is in and through his word. Now, that's of great importance because you see, some of the disappointment that Elijah experienced was disappointment that was caused because possibly he expected God to go on and do something that was going to be even more dramatic than Carmel. He expected God to do something in the instant. And what God was planning to do, you see, was something far bigger than this and far broader than this. He was planning to do it not just through Elijah, but through Elisha. And one of the things God tells him here is, "I've got another man, not just 7,000, but a special man, Elisha, who is going to be the prophet of God in your place, and I'm going to carry on the work through him." And Elijah had to learn that there was a limited sphere in which God meant him to serve and act. But most of all, that it was not through the drama, it was through his word. Now, sometimes, you know, we can have a fleshly craving for the dramatic and the spectacular and the impressive, when God's real way of working is quietly through his word, persistently over a long period of time. And this is one of the lessons I think Elijah was learning in Horeb. Then he restores him to his service and to fruitfulness and to authority. Verse 15, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you arrive," he then begins to tell him about the people he shall anoint. Elijah is not only going to be restored to serve God, but he is going to be given the authority of God to lay his hand upon those whom God is going to use. And he is being assured again that God is in sovereign control of this situation, that God is in sovereign control of all these evil forces that he is afraid of. And so he says to him, "Anoint Hazael to be king over Syria, and Jehu the king over Israel, and Elisha the son of Shaphat you shall anoint to be prophet in your place, and him who escapes from the sword of Hazael shall Jehu slay, and him who escapes from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha slay." And he is assuring Elijah that he is in sovereign control of the situation. And then that he will leave. I don't think it is really "I have left" in verse 18, but "I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal." Now you see, the interesting thing is that part of the way that these 7,000 were brought was through Elijah's ministry. And one of the things God is showing Elijah is that here again there is a longer term purpose that God has. Through his ministry, he has a great army of prophets who are going to be raised up. And in the future, the fruit of Elijah's ministry may appear when he is in glory. What does it all amount to? Well, it all amounts to God's restoring grace. As always, the devil has overreached himself, you see. Because the vital thing is that when a man like Elijah falls, as fall he did, into a deep despair, he falls into the loving arms of a tender-hearted God. That's what happens when he falls. And so he is able to say, "Rejoice not against me, O mine adversary. When I fall, I shall rise again. When I sit in darkness, the Lord shall be a light unto me." And he was, and he will be. It doesn't matter what the situation, he will be. And we shall rise again to serve and honor and love him. Now let us sing about all that together in our closing hymn number 675.